We will officially call the meeting to order. And we will get started with a review and approval of the minutes. Has everyone had a chance to review them? Any comments?
Madam Chair, move approval of the minutes as presented.
Second that motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And we have a vote from Aline online as well. Rex, committee reports?
All right. Well, we've got quite a long list given that the last meeting was May 29th for the OIC. On June 20th, on behalf of OPERF, the OST Investment Committee approved the following investments: $150 million to Lotus Infrastructure Fund 4, $110 million to Hamas Income and Growth Healthcare Fund, July 24th, 100 million euros to Harrison Street European Core Fund, and 100 million to Sculptor Real Estate Fund 5. And then under staff discretion, on June 26th, I approved 13 million to USV 2024 Core Fund, July 16th, 50 million to Harrison Street Infrastructure Fund Co-Investment Sidecar. And then lastly, on behalf of the Common School Fund, $10 million for Sculptor Real Estate Fund 5.
Thank you. The OPERF second quarter performance report. Mika and Alan from Makita. And welcome.
Ah, here we go. I promised Mika I would start with this. The most important thing I can tell you is to buy low and sell high. And it's really good advice, and it doesn't cost anything. Doing it is a challenge. But it's really good advice. I'm just going to do a brief intro, and then I'll do comments on the majority of the presentation. But it's just important when you give presentations like this, and I've been coming here for 40 years, it's hard to believe, but for 40 years, is you need a 40-year horizon. You're going to fund an institution that's a perpetuity. And it's really, really important to think long term and to view it as a ultra marathon and not a sprint. And that's really to help put today's presentation in context, because the sole purpose is, at least for the retirement plan, is to make sure there's adequate assets to meet benefits that have been promised to the beneficiaries. That's what you're here for. Investing is fun. What Kevin does isn't quite as much fun, but it's really what you're here for. It's just really important, at least regarding the retirement plan, to remember that. The performance report is a retrospective. It looks backwards. But its only real importance is to be a source of information to help you look forward. Because, in fact, what happens in the future will dictate what happens in your ability to meet obligations. And whatever has happened has happened. It's in the past. You have to learn from it. There's information there. But it's not where your focus should be. The focus should be on the future. And just in closing, Rex gave me a tour of the back earlier. It's just important to put it in context. Your staff is deeper, more knowledgeable, and more experienced than any time in history. And it needs to be, because the capital markets have grown so much more complex. The challenges you face from every direction are greater than they've been any time in my career. And having a deep, talented staff is crucial to implementing an investment program that has the potential to meet the obligations that have been promised. So, that's my introduction, a little bit different than we ordinarily hear, but I just wanted to give you some context. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
So my comments will start on page 6, which I've pulled up. Thank you for the clicker, by the way. I feel in control of my own destiny a little bit this morning. And a couple of comments as we get to the outset of the second quarter report. One, we sit here having now wrapped up the month of August and sitting in early September. So some of this data feels like it's been a little while, but I think it's important to put the marketplace into context so that when we look through the performance, you have the backdrop. So I'll spend a few moments on that. I'll also just give a brief update on sort of where the markets sit today so you can have a little perspective as we look out at the rest of 2024. The most important things that we highlight in terms of the economic environment here, I think, are some things that we all know well and watch in the headlines day over day. So large cap tech stocks still drove the markets in the second quarter. So that is a big theme that you'll see kind of funneling its way through to particularly the equity component of the portfolio and really just driving headline returns across stock markets in the United States. So when we look outside of the U.S., there were some other factors influencing returns. Strength in the dollar in the second quarter was a headwind in some of these places. A lot of uncertainty politically across the globe. You add to some of the items that we've been talking about over the last couple of years with Russia, Ukraine, Gaza more recently, a lot of issues in Somalia, just highlighting how global a lot of these challenges are, and they affect everything from defense spending in various developed economies to just the political environment. And one of the things that we talked about, I think, 9 months ago as we were getting ready to head into 2024 is just the backdrop of elections across the globe. So it's not just here in the U.S. where we face elections, but we've already moved through dozens across the globe. We continue to see more elections, and that backdrop also creates uncertainty in various marketplaces, more certainty in others, but the ultimate effect on the marketplace is opportunities for things like what we saw with Japan in early August and the yen carry trade. You know, these little events that are the effect of different central banks, different countries dealing with their own inflation environment, dealing with their own political environment in ways that hit the news cycle and can create some meaningful effects to investment markets. So we did see kind of a big equity market drawdown in early August coming out of what had been a very positive period of time, and that kind of roiled markets for really just a short period of a few days. So just wanted to kind of provide the backdrop that from our perspective, continuing to see at this point what Fed rate cuts look like. We have a little more certainty today than we did the last time we met in May. It's looking more and more likely that we see a couple at least of rate cuts this year. The question marks, I think, remain on whether we see 25 basis points or 50 basis points at a time. But as we start that cycle, it will have big impacts on fixed income markets and really potentially equity markets as well. So this slide that we look at every quarter on page 7 is just a snapshot of index returns. And again, I highlighted that the second quarter risk assets did quite well in the marketplace. You see stocks, and actually China, one thing I failed to mention was that China was a big driver of positive returns in the second quarter. And you saw China's rally really drive emerging market equities higher. So emerging markets up 5% for the period. You'll actually note that your portfolio's emerging markets did even better than its index returns over the last year. The S&P 500 up 4%. And then you work your way down. What we saw in the second quarter and where things have shifted a bit as we sit today is that Bloomberg aggregate, so core fixed income, was relatively neutral, sort of not much of a return there as the marketplace was kind of digesting where we were going to be going with rates in the future and broader economic uncertainty. Today, actually, as we sit, if you look over at that year-to-date column on the left-hand side, fixed income assets are up over 3% in core fixed income now year-to-date. So there's been a bit of a rally in terms of returns from bonds over on the left-hand side of the page. I also wanted to note, as we sit here looking back through August now, the S&P 500 returns are approaching 20% for the year. As you move a little bit further down that page, emerging markets are up almost 10%. EFA, so non-US developed markets, up 12% on the year-to-date period. So very, very strong results from equity markets over the course of the year. And as I mentioned, now somewhat more positive returns from fixed income markets is overall a good thing for a fund like yours, right? That helps contribute towards getting to that actuarial assumed rate of return. We'll talk about some of the headwinds in the portfolio as we get into your specific performance. I did want to just highlight briefly on page 12, just from a fixed income standpoint, because I mentioned kind of where things sit today, I think it's worth highlighting that, you know, when we talk about risk assets doing well in the equity markets, broadly speaking, that tends to be good for riskier assets in the fixed income markets as well, and that finds its way to places like the high yield marketplace. So when you look at really the year to date and 1 year returns for the Bloomberg High Yield Index, you see over the 1 year high yield bonds up 10.4%. So just highlighting that, you know, there are other places in fixed income where some of that risk shows through in terms of market results as well that are more aligned with and more correlated with the equity markets. I love this chart and I know I've shared it with you all before, but I think it's important. As we think about the risks to the market and we continue to talk about what might happen kind of in the U.S. economy and as we move through the rest of this year, one of the biggest factors in the growth of the economy in the U.S. is the consumer, and the consumer has been very resilient. That's one of the topics that, you know, keeps coming up time and time again in economic reviews, is that the consumer has been stronger than anyone had expected and continues to spend. But I note the two charts at the top of this page as not a counterpoint, because the consumer has still been spending, but they're now spending at a rate that causes more credit card debt potentially. And as student loans have kicked back in and there are payments, what you're seeing is that that revolving debt that people are carrying has shot up a bit at the same time that interest rates shot up quite a lot. So now debt that people are carrying is at a higher interest rate, which obviously has a compounding effect over time. So I just highlight this as one of the risks to the economic environment, obviously, if consumers don't feel as comfortable spending as we head into this holiday season or we head into 2025, that will certainly be a potential risk to markets as we move forward. And then finally, you know, I mentioned obviously watching central bank policy across the globe. This is just a chart that kind of tries to paint a picture of what rates looked like at the end of June across just five or six of the components of the globe. So the U.S. is in blue. Again, you see obviously in 2022, our rates moving up and now having been very stable for the last year and a half or so, likely to see kind of that dip down. You have seen places like the European Central Bank cutting rates already a little bit ahead of the U.S. And then, as I mentioned, Japan kind of moving the other direction, moving away from that zero interest rate policy into having interest rates around 25 basis points today. So we'll continue to watch. But as all of these lines intersect, again, just a lot of room for both speculation on the part of investors and then also a lot of consternation for governments as they try to work through their various economic situations. Any questions or comments from the council on the markets before we walk into the OPIR portfolio specifically? Okay, seeing none, hearing none. I'll move to page 24, which is just the snapshot performance review summary that we provide each quarter. And I know at the last meeting we had a conversation around, you know, our color scheme here, which is just trying to highlight for you in a quick snapshot whether things are performing better or worse than benchmark in several areas. So we use a few different benchmarks, the way that I refer to them on the left. So you have the policy benchmark on the top there. You see that for both the quarter and now for the 5 years, really driven by recent performance. So I want to highlight that even when we're looking at 5-year trailing results, when you have a period like we've had over the last year where there's meaningful underperformance at the total OPERF level, that impacts the trailing results. It's certainly not that you have been underperforming year over year for the last 5 years. But as we sit today, that return is 8% relative to an 8.3% policy benchmark return. When you think about that relative to your actuarial assumed rate, it looks much more positive. So 8% compares quite favorably to that 6.9% actuarial rate. And this is, when you think about the objectives of a fund like OPERF, over long periods of time, paying those benefits is the ultimate goal of this pool of capital. And so to me, that's a really critical measure, right? You have been able to, and you continue to move in a positive way on your funding path, which is a really important consideration when you look at the health of this pension over time. So I just want to highlight that that to me is a really important piece of information to look at. The third, and by all counts, the least important of the three benchmarks that we take a look at here, is just relative to peers. To me, this is just a snapshot to let you have a sense for what other large pension funds have done over the period. And you see that for the quarter, you're pretty close to in line, very slightly below median for the quarterly results, and over 5 years, still outperforming pretty handily that group by about 70 basis points. We share some data on how the actively managed portfolios in OPERF are performing. To me, the quarterly results are just noise, and so I wouldn't take too much away except for to assume that you're probably going to see slightly more than half doing one thing in any given quarterly period. But over 5 years, you should start to see some patterns and consistency. And so you see that 16 of the 17 actively managed portfolios outperformed over that five-year period. In terms of compliance with targets, this is an area that we've highlighted the last several quarters. And I think, again, everyone is aware of the fact that private equity remains above targets, which means public equity and fixed income are underweight. Real assets also remain overweight in the portfolio. And so these are the largest drivers of what your results look like in a period where, remember that not only are you overweight to private equity, but your benchmark for private equity is a public market benchmark plus a premium. And so when we look at the one-year benchmark for private equity, for example, it's up over 32%, which is a very, very significant bogey for any portfolio, but particularly in private equity where you had things not be marked down so substantially. Just a year and a half or 2 years ago, we were all very thankful for the way that private equity could sort of buoy performance across a drawdown. And now I think it's not unexpected that in a period that's moved the other way that you would see kind of the opposite effect in the portfolio. Any questions here before I move forward? On 25, this is just the snapshot of the numbers through time. And I think a couple of things to highlight are, you know, as we move across from left to right, kind of your quarterly results, 1, 3, 5, and 10, I focused on the 5 year on the previous page. Did want to note that while in the 1, 5, and 10 year periods, OPERF is now underperforming that policy benchmark, the 3 year period, you're still outperforming by about 50 basis points. So kind of thinking about the various time periods we look at, it's why we like to look at things on a variety of different time frames so you can get a sense for how portfolio performance is holding up. And then at the very bottom, you do see that peer ranking. So I shared with you the median on the last slide. This now shows you what that ranking looks like. And over the more recent time periods, you see bottom quartile results. I think that's, again, given the significant exposure to private markets and its drag on your returns, is not unexpected. But when you look at the 3, 5, and 10 years, performance is well above median, and over the 3 and 10 year periods in the top quartile. So the next several slides are the attribution reports that we put together. I was just going to cover a couple of them and then can answer questions and we can turn to any that you might want to. I will show the quarterly. I know that I've highlighted this in the past. We have to be a little bit careful about taking too much away from one quarter of attribution, particularly as it relates to the private markets, because again, we're talking about assets that are not valued on a daily basis. So importantly, though, when we look at the quarterly period, and if you think about just the results of OPERF relative to the benchmark, which is what this attribution is comparing, you see, and again, the orange dot is always the total effect of how the portfolio has done relative to the benchmark. So in that top line, you see that OPERF underperformed. It kind of falls in the center of the blue. And then we look at a couple of different effects. One, the allocation effect in green. So were your dollars towards various asset classes helping or hurting? And then in blue, was the performance of that asset class relative to its benchmark helping or hurting your performance? And I know I went through this last time, but the interaction effect, which is more complex, tries to get to the heart of being overweight an asset class that might have underperformed, in this case, private equity, or in other cases, you could be underweighted. This is just how things kind of interact in other ways that contribute to performance. So to me, really focus on the green and the blue and acknowledge that the pink may be telling a slightly different but related story. So in this case for the quarter, again, not a huge surprise. Private equity is the driver of underperformance. You do see that from an allocation standpoint, several asset categories contributing positively, particularly fixed income. You see real assets also on a selection basis contributing positively to performance in the period as well. I wanted to go ahead and move to the 3 years because, again, we show one quarter, 1 year, 3 years, and 5 years. So I'll focus on 3 years here and then be happy to answer questions about any of the other timeframes that are available. This is on page 28 for anyone following along on your own screens. And again, what we're looking at here are the broader attribution across the portfolio. And a couple of things stand out to me. One, over the three-year period, the portfolio outperformed its benchmarks. You see the orange dot on the right-hand side of the axis there. And then as you work your way down, a few things contribute positively. Fixed income on both a selection and an allocation basis. Now, this is when we work through the various components of portfolio performance, keep in mind that your fixed income portfolio includes a variety of fixed income types. And when we compare to kind of total fund performance, in some cases, you have a more core-like benchmark. So that can affect your portfolio in different ways in different time periods. As you work your way down a little bit more, public equity, a little bit, and I don't think this is a surprise, the underweight to public equity in a period of time where, broadly speaking, public equity markets have done quite well, certainly hurts performance. This is exacerbated by your need to pay benefits. We've talked about this several times at this meeting as well. Fixed income and public equities are really the two liquid components of your portfolio where you draw capital. And so as you have needed capital and as you underweight that asset class in a period of time where it's rallying, that has hurt your portfolio even more than just the overweight to private equity. And if you work your way a little bit further down, again, you see that contribution from private equity in the period. Now, when you see the positive green, the allocation effect, just keeping in mind what that attribution is telling you, which is what was your total fund return over that period, and then what was the total return of the asset category. And so, for example, for the three-year period, the total return for the fund was 5.1%. And if you look at the total fund for private equity for 3 years, it was 9.1%. So even though the blue line is to the left and it underperformed its benchmark, an allocation to private equity still helped contribute to positive performance at the total fund level. So that's really what the attribution charts are helping break out here. Any questions about attribution or about portfolio performance? I wasn't going to go slide by slide through the performance of each asset class, but I did want to note that while the overall picture for the second quarter and the one-year period may feel a little bit challenged, there are a lot of places of strength in the portfolio. And so these slides start on 37. And again, I won't go through them in detail, but I did want to highlight that, you know, in areas like broadly fixed income, your total public equity portfolio, your total real estate portfolio, the opportunity portfolio, real assets, and even cash. In all of these areas, your portfolio added value over the one-year period relative to benchmarks in those categories. And so just wanted to highlight that a lot of good work continues to be done. And again, a lot of the private equity challenge is related to that public markets benchmark that we have discussed at length. And I know much has been discussed in your private equity reviews as well. So to me, this is a short-term conversation about what's going on in public equity markets versus private equity markets. The overweight conversation is a separate and longer term challenge that we've talked about. And I think one that, you know, your staff is spending a lot of time considering and looking for opportunities to improve. So to me, kind of two separate conversations. Not at all surprised to see any private equity portfolio today underperforming a public markets benchmark. The overweight situation has persisted longer and probably deserves continued attention as it has been getting.
Lorraine Arvin, on page 35, I know, I'm sure I've seen this slide before many times, but, you know, I was looking at the alternatives and the median in the DB plans over $5 billion being 18.5%, and that just struck me as really low, certainly low compared to us. But, you know, still on the lower side. And I'm wondering what just for some comments about that and why we are so different. I understand we're at the high end of our range, you know, so our range, what, is 20 to 28 or 27? So that would imply more 24. But,
maybe, yeah. Great question, and thank you. So one of the challenges with, and so this slide, just for everybody looking at this, what we're looking at here is just exposure to various asset categories. And so the ranking isn't about performance, it's about exposure. So just so that we're all on the same page. And so our alternatives exposure here is showing 44%. This is combining several asset categories for OPERF into the alternatives exposure, things like private equity and other private assets. I will note that this is a self-reported category. And so the way that this system, which unfortunately I don't have transparency into how all the other plans feed into it, but what I can tell you is some plans, for example, would include something like real estate into alternatives. Other plans may not. Some plans may have hedge funds broken out in different ways. And so I'd be a little careful, and your very rightful comment might be, then why are you showing us this slide? But I'd be a little careful taking too much away from that grouping. I do think you have more private equity than average. I think that's a fair statement, and that contributes to this. But I don't know if the 18% median is actually reflecting the same type of portfolio exposures that you see at OPERF. So I wish that I could give you a perfect breakdown, but it's all related to how every fund categorizes their various asset categories. I can try to, and I think I mentioned it last time, but failed to do it in this report. There should be some additional categories that we could add to give you better detail into just your private equity exposure, for example, relative to peers. So I will make sure that we get that added for next time.
But just in terms of context, this fund has historically been at the high end of the range of illiquid assets across the board. So, and at this point in time, there's only a handful of other large funds that are similar in terms of their exposure to the combination of private equity, infrastructure, real estate, and to the extent you put hedge funds or other sort of illiquid vehicles in there, you're at the high end of the range. That's an asset allocation decision. That is the most important decision you make. You either hit a home run, which for over a decade or 15 years, you've hit a home run with that asset allocation, and right now you're on the other side of that curve. The good news is you're other side of the curve and numbers aren't in brackets. Yes, you have lower rates of return, but over the very long term, you've had extraordinarily good rates of return and benefited from that exposure. And the staff, under your direction, is making every effort they can to modify the strategic allocation to get it back within bounds. If it was easy, it would have been done yesterday. And it's just really important to recognize the challenge of when you have that sort of commitment, unwinding it doesn't happen overnight. But your observation is completely accurate that relative to almost all of your peers, you're at the very high end of the range.
What we're showing here is our actuals, not our target.
Correct.
I believe it is correct to say that even at our targets, we're still at the higher end of the range.
You would still be at the higher end of the range, but somewhat less so, maybe 8 percentage points lower than where you are today.
Yep.
That concluded my prepared remarks on performance. Again, happy to answer other questions. I note that there are, you know, a lot of additional pages in these reports that get into the detail at both the asset class and the manager level, but I think for this council's interest, it's really important to think about these bigger picture items, which is where a lot of the time and energy gets spent. And then I think you hear good detail from each of your asset class heads when they come in and kind of talk to you about, both in committee and at meetings, what's been going on in their portfolios.
You may or may not be prepared to speak to this, and if not, perfectly fine. But can you talk at all about performance relative to a reference portfolio, 70-30?
I thought that we actually had that.
The number is in there. I don't have the page up in front of me, but and I just think it's important, similar to the attribution study, which sort of says, does it make sense to be in the asset class at all? Yes, it does. The allocation effect is positive. Okay, and then within it, how well we should be in it, but how well are we doing in it is the selection. And I think about the reference portfolio sort of as, should we be doing any of this? Not any of this, but if we can do better with the similar amount of risk, which we've said here, a 70-30 portfolio is in alignment with the risk that our target allocation would achieve based on equities or return seeking versus risk mitigating. If we could do as well with a similar amount of risk, then does it make sense to be doing all of this work, spending all of this money, taking all of this time, adding complications, systemic risk, liquidity, all of these things. So I'd love for that just to be a part of what we talk about every time.
Go first.
Okay. So, and just so that everyone can see the numbers, although it's a little bit of an eye test, or I'm just getting older, but on page 40, we do show both a 60-40 and a 70-30 benchmark. A couple of comments, and this comment has maybe been true since the global financial crisis. So it's a bit, I think, to your point, it has been a period where long-only public equities have, with the benefit of a lot of support in liquidity in the marketplace for a period of time, less so today, but public equity markets have dominated returns over the last many years. And so it does sometimes feel, looking at a more complex portfolio, like, don't you just wish that you could be in a traditional 70-30 portfolio? What I would note is that although over the last year that would have benefited you significantly, if you look across the page here to, let's look at the 5 and the 10-year period, what you see is that a 70-30 was up 7.6% annualized over 5 years and 6.5% annualized over 10 years. Your portfolio was up 8 and 7.3. So about 40 basis points better over 5 years and 80 basis points better over 10 years. I did not have a chance to do the math before this meeting, but on an annualized basis, those are real significant numbers. And so that complexity in your portfolio, and these are all net of fees, so these include all of the carry, all of the fees that you're paying kind of across these portfolios, it has resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars of outperformance to this portfolio. So although in short periods, I think sometimes it feels like a lot of work is being done and maybe you wish you had that 32.5% public equity plus 300 return instead, to me, the long term is where you really see the results.
And I'll go back to my beginning comments, and that is, once again, that is looking backwards. In fact, if you look forwards, the tool that we collectively use to look forward was strategic asset allocation, and the assumptions embedded in the strategic asset allocation assumed you would get a higher return from those illiquid assets, or they would be providing significant diversification. So the question becomes, are those assumptions wrong? And I think reasonable people could argue one way or the other, but at least we as a consulting firm, we believe that you will get a premium from those strategies or added diversification, so they deserve to be in the portfolio.
If I could add one additional context here, and I always feel really uncomfortable looking at point in time numbers and patting ourselves on the back when it's outperformance and feeling bad when it's low performance. But the other way you could also look at it is, historically speaking, again, I completely agree with Alan's perspective. This is his history. But one thing to keep in mind is that over a 5-year period, over the last 27 years or so, 85% of those rolling 5-year periods, OPERF has outperformed the 70-30 reference portfolio. That is to say, 15% of the time, it has not. So just put that 15% in context when we are negative to a reference portfolio. And I think sort of stick to the idea that we have an asset allocation that we are trying to stick to with embedded assumptions underlying it, and that you sort of need to trust the system over a longer period of time.
Thank you.
It's on the performance review. Any closing remarks?
Give me a mic and I can't help myself.
I'm the same way. That's why I thought I would offer it to you as well.
Looking forward, I think it's really important to recognize we've gone through an unbelievable period in the capital markets, and not to expect there to be significant bumps in the next period of time, whether that's through the election or next year. If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't share it. But I don't know the answer, but I do know there is a very high probability you're going to see a level of volatility that we have not seen, because we've had extraordinarily low levels of volatility in all of the public markets since the global financial crisis. And that was done in part artificially because of central bank policy. But it has been very, very low risk environment. That may not continue. And so one should be prepared. And in fact, having lots of illiquid investments that do not get marked to market during periods like that end up being a very happy place to be. You don't want it to happen, but one should not be surprised. And part of our job looking forward is to at least say there is not a low probability that there will be continued low volatility going forward. And diversification is the key.
Okay. Thank you both. We'll continue with performance reviews. We have a Common School Fund performance review. Interestingly, led by Mike Langdon. Louise and Jamie. Just a reminder to, is the green light on? Yep. Yes. And just a reminder to announce yourself when speaking.
Probably have chances of just any point along the way and questions. Jumping in real quick, I always like to start presentations with a little bit of context, reminder of what the fund is, what's probably repetitive to what times now, so but the Common School Fund is an endowment fund that provides financial support for public education here in the state of Oregon. It has a net asset value currently $1, which is an all-time high. It is operationally owned and administered by the department. I think policy is set by the Bergen Investment Council. That's the strategy for the fund to be implemented by the staff here at the investment. Be a little bit more specific. This is an endowment fund that is nearly 165 years old, and it has sort of a dual mandate. It provides distributions out to primary and secondary funds in a matter that's meant to be both perpetual and equitable. What that means for us in this room is to generate for time that some government and an allowance can be commissioned. As we sit here today, the regular wage distribution policy is 3.5%. That by the state. There is also
Hey, Mike, can I just interrupt you?
Yep.
Oh, okay. He's handling. They can't hear you online.
Ah, so the light was not, in fact, on. It appeared to be on. So to back up a second, again, to meet this fund's mission, you need to generate a net return over time that sums up to at least the distribution policy and inflation. As we sit here today, the regular way distribution policy is 3.5%. There is also currently a formulaic distribution that goes out to fund the school district unfunded liability as part of SB 1566. Add on to that some additional expenses, and this fund needs to generate a return north of 7% to meet its long-term objectives. On that basis, we developed a new asset allocation back in 2022, and Jamie's going to talk us through that in a second. The good news is recent performance has been above that hurdle, which is very helpful, and Luis is going to give us an update on where we stand with respect to performance. We would expect to be in this mid-single-digit distribution zone for at least the next several years, certainly through 2027, when it is expected that SB 1566 phases out. However, from a day-to-day perspective in managing this portfolio, our going-in assumption is we're going to be in that mid-single-digit distribution policy all-in zone for the foreseeable future, and we're managing the portfolio with that mindset. So with that, if there's no questions, I'll hand it over to Jamie.
We got new mics, obviously. There's new mics up here. All right, for the record, Jamie McCurry, and I'll be discussing slide 5, I believe. Yes. All right, total fund asset allocation. So similar story that we discussed back in March. The modifications that arose from the November 2022 asset allocation study, those changes were a 5% increase to private equity coming off of fixed income, a continued build out of the diversifying allocations to real estate, real assets, and diversifying strategies, and then also a modest increase to the underlying allowance to non-core assets within the real estate portfolio. As most of the changes, you know, that we've discussed, I feel like within both a couple different investment portfolios that we manage, the exposure to alternative assets, then the implementation can take several years. The OIC specified an interim target, which allows the more the transition of the policy benchmark to fall in line with the transition of the implementation of the portfolio. Nearly 2 years into this plan, we've made a lot of progress, but you're not fully seeing that reflected in the asset allocation currently. Most notably, that is the private equity remains below its interim target of 12.5%, and currently the allocation sitting at 7%. This is really a function of the environment since 2022 when we began ramping up and increasing this allocation. We have scaled up pacing in this space, but we've yet to see that come into play with obviously the muted M&A activity. And so that makes the kind of commitments behind schedule for deployment. In effect, you know, we're committing the capital, the investments are not being called, it's not increasing the NAV, they're not putting that money to work yet. But as Louise will take us through in a moment, it's actually been a nice positive for the portfolio as the public markets have had a really nice return over, especially the last year. Yes.
Lorraine Arvin, can you remind us, you know, the bite size on the private equity is really small, right? And, you know, generally we try to use the same managers, but they probably don't have bite sizes of applicable to this fund. So can you remind us as to what universe of managers you're looking at or how you work with current managers in getting smaller allocations?
So it is always in the alternative space. In the alternative space, it's always a subset of the managers that go into the OPERF portfolio. In private equity, the average commitment is currently $15 million for the Common School Fund. For real estate, for a value-add fund, it might be $10 million. And then in the real asset portfolio and in the DSP portfolio, we have been able to get sub $10 million, almost $7.5 million in some cases. Usually these funds have minimum investments of $10 million. In practice, that's not always enforced by the general partner. Some managers frankly don't want another line item from an administrative standpoint, so they're happy to have a very large relationship with OPERF, but not interested in a very small commitment from Common School Fund. But by and large, we're able to navigate that. So the limiting factor are twofold. First, operationally, we don't have the in-house capability to look at a broader universe of smaller managers that don't make sense for both portfolios. And that's part resource, part the challenges of negotiating legals the way we have to for a small fund, all of the above. But more often than not, we manage to make it work. And what we back into is the reason a OPERF manager doesn't end up in the Common School Fund is usually not the case that the manager doesn't want it. It's that their strategy might just be too concentrated to find their way into the Common School Fund. So we have some managers that might make 7 investments, 10 investments per fund. That would create a level of concentration in a more narrow GP roster for the Common School Fund that we're uncomfortable with. So that's usually the deciding factor versus limitations that are put on us from the managers.
I just wanted to point out on the performance, on the allocation discussion, that I'm certain that a significant portion of the over allocation to public equities has to do with the performance of asset classes. And so while we may be trying to ramp up our pacing, all that we may need is a sell-off in public equity, and our original planned pacing may be right on the mark. And I'm not saying there will be a sell-off in public equity, but just to keep, for everyone to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment in regards to that. And that's why I always like to point out too that our total equity exposure is still in line with the overall allocation. And then the continued build out of the asset allocation is broadly on plan with the real estate, real assets diversifying strategies. And as well as we, you know, are at the final stages of the public equity restructure. And that was a meaningful change to the manager roster, as well as the overweights to size and value factors within the portfolio and a reduction in active risk. And so with time and with the help of the investment division's recently hired SIOs in fixed income and diversifying strategies, we'll seek to similarly revisit implementation in those two asset classes. But if there's no further questions on asset allocation, I'll hand it over to Louise to talk on performance.
One more. I should know this, but what was our target date to get to the long-term target? This asset allocation was approved, I think, at the end of 2022. We're almost 2 years in. I just cannot remember what is considered interim and what is considered long-term for this discussion.
I'm probably wrong, but my memory says 5 years.
Okay. I know that Common School Fund is different than OPERF, but we have made a concentrated effort to give more meaningful attention to Common School Fund and the other programs that we have with bringing on Jamie. How often would we revisit that asset allocation? Is it something that we would do every 3 years? So a five-year long-term target is out of whack with, we'd be redoing the exercise before then.
So for OPERF, we like to do it every 4 years. It's probably a similar type of time frame for all of these funds. I think historically speaking, the practice has been generally about 4 years, plus or minus a little bit. But I think the five-year number, and again, I might be wrong about the five-year number, but assuming that it is correct, that my memory serves me well enough, a lot of that has to do with the pacing program for privates, right? We want to be consistent. We don't want to get too fast. We also don't want to be too slow. It's the exact same conversation we're having for OPERF, right? For OPERF, we're talking about slowing down the pacing. For Common School Fund, we're not accelerating the pacing. We're just trying to keep it consistent, and therefore it's going to take us longer to get there. But we know we'll hopefully get there. Assuming our assumptions for the pacing meets, we should get there within time.
Just seeking that.
Well, it's a good question, because and we'll take your guidance. We had actually planned to do it next year on a three-year cycle. That's what we're supposed to do. So we can do it next year. We can do it the year after. I think there is some benefit to having an interim check, because we will have some events that happen in the 2028 time frame, which we'll come to. But anyway, Louise, please.
Great. And for the record, Louise Howard. Okay, great. And for performance, the headline is that it's been solid for the review period, the year ending June 30, 2024. And as you'll see, on an absolute basis, the fund has generated a return north of 10%. And this is comfortably above the nominal return level that we require to maintain the fund's distribution policy while meeting the perpetual horizon for the Common School Fund. Now, on a relative basis, the fund was below the policy benchmark. But again, this is mostly attributable to the private equity allocation, which, as Mika mentioned, has a benchmark reflecting public equity markets. And as we've seen, private and public equities have remarkably uncorrelated. They've been remarkably uncorrelated since the Fed started its aggressive rate tightening back in 2022. So, again, reflecting what Mika shared with us. And as Jamie mentioned, you know, we're behind plan with respect to scaling up our exposure to private equity, so that allocation effect of being underweight has been a net positive to the fund. If you could flip one more, thank you. And beyond that, the rest of the portfolio is performing largely as we would expect, even though we're in the middle of shifting the asset allocation. And, you know, just to sort of end on the positive note that Mike started with, the NAV for the Common School Fund is at $2.4 billion, so an all-time high. And if no questions for me, we're going to turn it right back over there.
So sort of in summary, we have made good progress at implementing the new asset allocation program that was adopted end of 2022, so almost 2 years ago now. While we acknowledge the current mix of exposures doesn't perfectly reflect as much, I can assure you all the sort of groundwork has been laid and the commitments have been made to make that progress we would have hoped to up to this point. And a lot of work continues to be done within the asset classes to try and refine our implementation and optimize what we're doing in all those asset classes. And for sure, that'll continue. As just outlined, performance has been encouraging in a very strong performance environment, which is good. It helps to bridge us through what could have been a tight distribution period for the fund. Looking forward, as I said a moment ago, our plan had us coming back on a three-year basis to revisit asset allocation. So that would be next year. To be frank, and I don't mean to get ahead of myself, but I don't know that there's going to be a huge argument to change the asset allocation next year. We're still in the process of implementing the 2022 plan. We don't foresee in the near term any changes to the distribution policy. So unless there's massive changes to our capital market assumptions or something like that, it would be tough to imagine an argument to make the change, but it's still valuable to revisit that and have the conversation. As we look out even further and we think about on a three-year cycle, doing this exercise again in 2028, we will necessarily have more firm guidance on the distribution policy because we expect SB 1566, or at least the parts that apply to the Common School Fund, to have some sunset at that point. But again, I think prudence alone has us in a zone where we just assume we will be in this mid-single digit distribution policy zone for the foreseeable future. So we're managing the portfolio with a much longer horizon, assuming that that's the zone we're going to be in. And I think we have a very good plan in place if that's the case. So that was really all we had. Happy to take any questions or comments.
Mike, are you saying in 2028, I mean, there's specific additional payouts occurring now with the 1566.
That's right.
Right. But those might continue. They may continue. They may not continue or be extended. Or other ones could take their place. Or the 3.5% base could be raised. I mean, there's lots of possibilities, right? And so you're saying that you're still thinking of a mid, you know, a 5% payout plus inflation needing to be covered in the longer horizon beyond 2028.
I think it's realistic to assume that whether the redirect to PERS phases out or not, that will necessarily mean we have to revisit the regular way distribution policy, or the state land board will revisit the regular way distribution policy. And importantly, as a data point, when the law was passed, the distribution policy was lowered by the state land board to account for the fact that there was this redirect. So it's likely and appropriate to go through the same math. So I think the safest thing for us to do is just assume it's going to be 4 or 5% like an endowment is, and we need to manage with that in mind.
Madam Chair, I might add a little perspective from the land board. I appreciate that conversation. I think the summary is quite accurate, and the strategy is sensible because things can always change. But I think the circumstances that led to 1566 are always kind of unique. You can't necessarily anticipate the way politics come together in the legislature and who feels what way about what policies. But in addition, I think the land board and the staff of the Department of State Lands have a better understanding now about the distribution formula. Historically, it had been the case that in a lot of circumstances, the Common School Fund is where governors looked to fund their incremental educational initiatives. And we really tried to make that point early on to say, no, we have to take this on in a specific, stable sort of way, not make it available for episodic kind of things. So we should always be cautious and vigilant against those things. But I think we have made a specific advance in terms of the understanding of the role that it plays. So good. Appreciate your conversation and appreciate the exchange. I think that's all sensible, but hopefully that's a little additional background that's helpful.
This is a little off topic of the performance of the Common School Fund, but fits in with the discussion, which is 1566 is a redirect to PERS.
Right.
So it is also benefiting PERS and the OPERF side of things. So when that goes away, it has an impact on us and or, you know, Kevin in a different way. But my take on that is that it's very small. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so $30 million.
Immaterial.
Yeah. Okay. From a PERS perspective.
From a PERS perspective.
Yeah. And if I could, most of those If I could, most of those are being sunset in the next few years. So, and if you look at the last revenue forecast that came out last week, there's nothing that shows any money coming into PERS from any of these funds. Okay.
Any other questions for the team on the Common School Fund, performance or otherwise? Good job. Thank you all. And with that, we'll take, let's say, a 10-minute break back here at 10:10 for a couple of action items. If people could take a seat, we'll get started. Aline, can you hear me and are you back with us?
I can hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
Great. Okay. So we have a couple of action items now, starting with some policy changes presented by Jamie.
Good morning again, Chair Samples and council members. For the record, Jamie Ricuri, Service Model Program Manager, and I'm here to present a couple of policy updates for you all. So to start, obviously, you are all aware fiduciary best practice is to review policy every 1 to 2 years. And a well-written comprehensive IPS is the best form of documentation as it clearly articulates the responsibilities for which roles, defines the purpose and objective of the investment pool, and it clearly provides guidelines for ongoing monitoring and execution of the assets. An IPS also ensures continuity by providing a framework for decision making, which is really great for as there's turnover, either staff, board members, et cetera. So today we'll be going over, first and foremost is obviously maintaining fiduciary best practices within policy. And some of it's gonna be a little bit more of kind of cleanup items of consolidating policies, streamlining language, clarifying ambiguous language. So I'll be presenting a handful of policies and seeking OIC approval on those. But before I jump into the policies I will be reviewing and bringing forward for approval, I wanted to give a high-level view of all the portfolios under OIC oversight and managed by Treasury. So with this chart And also to go into, before I start that, is, my role in joining Treasury is to really help to oversee all the portfolios that the Treasury manages outside of OPERF, but I still provide guidance and oversight on all policy with the Investment Division, so I am part of some of the policy discussions in regards to OPERF as well. But I've been spending my time, especially this last year, of really meeting with what I call, my clients. And those could be, the local governments, the state agencies, the university point person, or different boards that are overseeing and that these funds are for. So getting a further understanding of their needs, reviewing policy with them to make sure that all still aligns, and then obviously working with internal staff as this is a large team effort on, policy updates and managing the assets. So these portfolios range in size from close to over $95 billion to $1 million. So totaling around $140 billion in assets that are within all these portfolios. And as you can see on the page, there are a lot of acronyms. So I will do my best not to use too many and kind of give example of what all of them stand for. But so please stop me if you need clarification as I walk through everything. This is where I'm going to spend a decent amount of time just giving that high level overview. So obviously on the top left, we have the three portfolios that are multi-asset class, OPERF, the pension, CSF, the Common School Fund, and SAFE, the State Accident Insurance Fund. So recently, obviously, We did the OPERF revamp of policy and consolidated and updated that to the, and then working on the guidelines of the asset classes, which was based off of the changes that we did to the Common School Fund investment policy back in 2022, I believe, was before my time. And then we are also in process, which I'll highlight in regards to SAFE. You'll see that the investment policies are listed under that currently has 7-8 policies. So doing the same that we did with Common School and OPERF, consolidating that into one and adding asset class guidelines. The next we have is the OSTF, the Oregon Short-Term Fund. This is one policy that I will be discussing and bringing forward for changes. Then we have the OITIP and the OLGIF. And those are two intermediate term portfolios that we manage. No changes to those policies. Those are staying as is. And then the top right-hand corner, we have the public universities. There's three portfolios that we manage for the universities. OPUF is one that we'll be discussing. That's the Oregon Public University Fund. So we'll be discussing that later. And the two endowments that we manage for Southern Oregon University and Western Oregon University, no changes to those policies. In the center of the page, we have the two other retirement plans that we've discussed, the IAP and the OSGP, which I will be bringing recommended changes to those two policies. And then down at the bottom, we have state agency accounts that we manage. A handful of these I will be bringing forward recommendations for, and two of them for the DCBS and ODOT, no changes to those policies, but we will be discussing DAS, the housing, vets, and the Oregon Lottery. Before I move in to jump into the policies, any questions on the big chart?
I feel like we should be quizzed on the acronyms.
There'll be a test on what some of these acronyms stand for.
I think you were already set that test.
I appreciate this chart.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah. Yes. I know I'm a visual person, so I needed to create something as I started diving into all of this. All right, so our first ones, as discussed, is in regards to the short-term investments. So the first two policies for review are the INV 303, which is the short-term investment policy, which is for the Oregon Short-Term Fund, OSTF. Within OSTF is the Time Certificate of Deposits Program, or TCD, which is currently a separate policy. It's INB 302. So on April 23rd, we reviewed the TCD program with the OSTF board. They approved the recommended changes that we brought forward and wanted to move that forward to OIC, because as a reminder, with the OSTF, there is the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board that oversees, and we meet with them on a quarterly basis. But before we get into policy, I did want to give a little bit of a background on the TCD program. It's a nice thought train. The Treasury will buy short-term TCDs from qualified institutions, which can be banks or credit unions, that make orders. The funds can then be used from the requesting institutions to make more loans into their communities. We work closely with the Department of Finance and Public Funds Collateralization Program, PFCP. And we send out those rates every quarter to the qualified institutions who wish to participate.
Madam Chair, can I ask a quick question on that one? Or maybe you're going to address this already, but just this is a result of my own confusion that Jamie already clarified, but just in case anyone else had the same confusion that I did. When I read through this, I was initially confused about the fact that there was a difference between the limit for credit unions and banks, and I misunderstood that is, in fact, what is being rectified here. So if you wouldn't mind making that clear, if in case anyone had the same confusion I did, I would appreciate it.
Yep, and I think that's a prime example of one of the cleanup items and clarification points of going through and reviewing policy is it used to just be banks, and then it was changed to banks and credit unions, but there was some mismatch in language within, you know, guidelines and policy in different places within different policies. So right now it is just qualified depositories, which is inclusive of banks and credit unions, so there is no limitation differences between them.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. And so with kind of that similar goal and kind of to that point is, you know, having the policy with then guidelines attached versus having some language within a policy, then it points to another policy. It's really cleaning it up and consolidating. So with that, we are cleaning up the language within INB 303, which is the short-term fund investments, and that's stripping out those explicit language regarding the exposures and all of that, because what we're doing is we further built out the TCD guidelines as a separate attachment that has all of those explicit, you know, cap limits, overall language, and clarifying language around the qualified depositories. So those are the main changes that we're bringing forward. So with that, INB 302 would be, in a sense, retired and turned into guidelines attached to INB 303, and further building out those guidelines, which is attached, and I have the red lines and the clean for you all to view. So if there's any questions on any of the guideline changes there, the build out.
You and I discussed this previously, but
yes.
Did we want to approve all at once or individually?
I would recommend I could go through all of it, and then at the end we can do one approval for all policies that I'm bringing forward, unless there's any major ones that you want to go through or not. But so switching gears now, INB 407A, which is for the Public Universities Core Bond Fund. Once again, this is not a fund that we discuss on the regular basis. So I did want to spend some time giving an update and some history on the public universities for their, and the OST, the funds that OST manages. So the Oregon University system was dissolved in 2014. All seven system members adopted independent boards. ORS Chapter 352 established authority for the Oregon public universities to invest monies and allow public universities to enter into agreements with the Oregon State Treasury to establish separate or commingled funds. In order for the OST to receive, hold, keep, and manage all the invested monies of the universities. So with that, in response to that change back in 2014, Oregon, the Treasury determined and built out a more robust policy for the public universities, which we call the Common Policy, which is INB 407. So that encompasses everything that we can manage for universities that choose to participate with us. So with that, not all universities do still participate in the programs. And the, one of the primary funds that we do manage is the Public Universities Core Bond Fund, which falls under INB 407A. This is an internally managed fixed income fund. The OIC approved the establishment of the Core Bond Fund and the guidelines back in 2014 when that change happened. And as of the end of July, OPUF, the Oregon Public University Fund, is around $390 million, just for reference. So the current policy incorporates university language that reflects their allocation between the OSTF and OPUF. And so what this is doing is, you know, basically creating clarifying language, and we just stripped out just the OPUF guidelines from that policy to make it its own attachment. This has no impact to the university's OSTF accounts, but it was stripping it out because it was a little convoluted of what was referencing to OSTF and their short-term cash needs and what was OPUF that was more intermediate cash needs for them. Right, some more fixed income oriented. You'll see a lot of this is fixed income oriented. So within INB 402, the internal fixed income investment policy, there are attachments and IPS guidelines for all the state agency funds that we manage that you saw listed at the bottom of that chart. Kind of keeping with consistency that we're doing with OPERF and CSF and SAFE was really creating that same consistency with policy for these state agencies, but then also tailoring to fit the needs, obviously, of those state agencies. So a handful of the agencies are invested really similarly. We work with those agencies to help determine, you know, what's the immediate cash needs and what they have in excess to be invested into more intermediate term bond funds, you know, that 1 to 3 year time frame. So with those agencies, the IPSs are really similar. You have three main sections. You have the investment objective sections highlighting preservation of capital, liquidity, return. And then the second section, it moves into more of the investment constraints, which that's where it really is tailored more to each of the state agencies. And the last section is compliance and reporting. So in review of a lot of these policies, it was maybe creating consistency or adding in some of this language so that they all fell within kind of the same policy framework. So the first step was INV 407 for DAS, the Department of Administrative Services. The updates there are updating the return language return objectives language to make it consistent with the policy template. And then we also added an OITIP as a permitted investment, which it didn't previously call it out. It was a little more ambiguous. And so this was making it very explicit. With INV 402E for VETS, the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs, this was a larger overhaul as we moved its previous format into this new format. But I will state that no policy changes were made in that restructure. But I would say the only small change was same as we added in the OITIP as an explicit investment option as it wasn't previously stated. The next two policies are a little bit different from the kind of formats that we had for the other. For housing, this was more of an administrative update. This was moving it into policy stat and making it as an attachment to INV 402. As it wasn't previously an attachment. The same for INV 402G, the Oregon Lottery. The admin update was once again bringing that into policy stat, making an attachment to INV 402, but also in working with the lottery and reviewing policy, we did update some language around risk that they wanted some clarification on. And then also we added in some language around Win for Life, which is a program within lottery. And what this did is it's created a liability stream beyond 30 years, which is beyond, you know, tips or I mean, treasuries that you can buy. And so they added in language of how to circumvent that and what they want to do for somebody that wins the lottery that's in their 20s and is going to live for longer than 30 years. So all red lines have been provided for those. Any questions on the fixed income? Okay, moving along. All right, next up is INV 801 and 802 for the OSGP. Reminder, the OSGP is the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. It's the 457 DC plan for state and local governments. INV 801 is the Deferred Compensation Investment Program Statement of Objectives. And INV 802 is the Deferred Compensation Investment Program, which talks about selecting, managing, reporting, and terminating program firms. So once again, keeping with consistency and consolidating policy is we recommend combining 801 and 802 as currently Section 6 of 801 basically says go to INV 802. So instead of directing you to another policy, we're bringing that language into this policy within Section 6. And so with that, we would then retire INV 802. The changes that we are recommending and bringing in are benchmark updates. And I know that always sounds a little scary, benchmark changes. But the first one is a really small cleanup item, especially with going through and reviewing. It's striking Barclays from the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Ag Bond Index because they no longer use Barclays in their branding. The next is an update to the socially responsible investment option. And this is updating the benchmark from the Russell 3000 to the S&P 500 index. This has been primarily driven to the underlying manager within this space updating their benchmark. And in reviewing this change, along with discussions with the manager, with the OSGP board, with staff, we recommend updating the policy benchmark to match what the manager changed to. And for reference, moving to the S&P 500 index, the large cap index, is a strategic repositioning of the fund and best aligns to relative to other large cap blend peers. Previously, the benchmark to the Russell 3000 index was a mismatch to the all cap strategy relative to broader large cap peers. The Russell 3000 index is made up of large, mid, and small cap companies, but the fund's allocation had very minimal exposure to the small and mid cap space. So with this change, it's been a pretty minor change to how they're managing. There's also considerable brand recognition for the S&P 500 with this being within the OSG program for participants is also nice to have. So staff will continue to monitor this as this is more of a recent change, but we feel good about this change and we like that consistency between reporting and policy. Any questions on those? Last up for approval is the IAP, and as a reminder, the IAP is the Individual Account Program. It's a defined contribution account-based retirement benefit for members of PERS. Within IAP, there's a default target date which is chosen for members based on their age. There is the option, which is called member choice, for them to then choose a different target date. And so we wanted to make sure that this language was added in regards to member choice within policy because that can impact the demographics review that we do for a study on every couple of years. So I wanted to make sure that that was within policy and recognized as an option. Currently, and I know probably Kevin can speak to, it's not currently a very widely used. We don't have a lot of people using that member choice option at the moment. So with that, if there aren't any questions, my recommendation would be to approve policy revisions and format changes as outlined in the attached documents.
I have a quick question, Chair. Yeah, thank you so much, Amy. This is just a learning question. The Oregon Intermediate Term Poll, could you speak briefly to that? I saw it was added to one of the policies. I think it's the
growth one. Yeah, so it was added within as an explicit line item within the two fixed income portfolios, DAS and VETS. And that is a Oregon Intermediate Term Pool Fund is for state agencies and public universities and intermediate term bond fund for them to invest in. So what we do, especially with DAS is we really help them determine that allocation balance between the Oregon Short-Term Fund and OITIP. So OSTF and OITIP for, you know, current cash needs, maybe they keep 6 months to a year of cash needs there, and then we reallocate an additional amount to OITIP for further, more longer-term cash needs, 1 to 3 year timeframes.
So this has always been done. It's you're just explicitly mentioning the fund in the policy document.
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I'll entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, before I make the motion, I just want to compliment the work and thank you for the clear explanation and really comprehensive approach to taking it on. And with that, I move approval of the recommendation and approval of the changes as presented.
I second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Thank you. And I echo the treasurer's comments. Thank you so much for your work, and I'm sure we'll
have some more of these coming up as well.
Well, with that, you will sneak peek. Yeah, so in October, we will be bringing forward the SAFE policy changes. With that, we've been working with Makeda to consolidate those policies, build out asset class guidelines, you know, further build out roles and responsibilities, all those same things that we've been discussing within OPERF and Common School Fund. So in October, you'll be receiving the annual update from on SAFE. We'll also be presenting the RBK asset allocation study, which is also going to play into some recommended changes within that policy. So,
Jamie, with SAFE, are we also looking at the IPS? I mean, these would be referred to probably in an IPS, and we redid the IPS, right, for Common School Fund and for OPERF.
Yeah, so what we would do currently, INB 1001 through 1008, that would get consolidated into one investment policy, which would most likely become INB 1001. And then the all those okay. some of those additional policies are actual just asset class specific, and those would turn into guidelines. So yep, it would fall exactly one primary investment policy statement. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so we will move to the next agenda item, which is also Jamie, and it's the OSGP consultant. And normally we may ask the consultants to excuse themselves, the consultants who are present, but I do not think that is necessary for this recommendation. So you all are welcome to stay in the room.
All right. Luckily, this time I get some company, but once again, for the record, Jamie McCrary, and joining me today is Claire Ilo. For my final presentation today, we'll be presenting a request for proposal, RFP, for the OSGP Oregon Savings Growth Plan Investment Consulting Services contract. We'll be bringing that forward for recommendation for approval. Before we get into the recommendation and the process that we went through, which Claire will be covering, I did want to state and remind Council that this recommendation falls under INV 210, which is the consulting contract, which is included in the packet for your reference. But the consulting contracts are generally awarded for three-year timeframes, and they can be renewed no more than twice. They reach a final limit after 4 years, so a seven-year time frame is the max of those policies. At the end of the 7 years, the contracts must be rebid, and a new seven-year cycle can begin. And additionally, the OIC retains the contractual right to terminate such contracts at any time with written notice. But Callan was the consultant for the OSGP plan. Their contract did reach their seven-year term, and we began the RFP process back in March. We were going to be bringing this forward in July for OIC approval, and now we're bringing it. And we did discuss, so I'll hand it over to Claire to go in.
Good morning. For the record, Claire Ilo, Investment Officer here at Treasury. So before diving into the RFP process and the services, I just wanted to again remind everyone that the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, OSGP, is the state of Oregon's 457 deferred compensation plan that provides Oregon public employees with just an easy way to save for retirement in addition to the pension and their IP. So today I plan to briefly just lay out the RFP search process that we went through, as well as the consulting services, before asking for your approval on this recommendation. So with regards to the RFP search process, in March of this year, we initiated the search to find a new consultant for the OSGP since Callan's seven-year contract was expiring at the end of August. So in March, a committee was formed to launch a formal procurement process to identify candidate firms. That committee was comprised of Dave Randall, Chief Investment Operating Officer, Jamie McCrary, Service Model Program Manager, and myself, Investment Officer. The committee was also overseen and administered by Julie Hall, who was chief procurement officer at the time. So on March 20th,
Claire, I just want to let the council know that, or say for the record, that they did offer a member of the OIC to sit on the committee, and we declined the need to be part of that discussion.
Thank you. on March 20th, the investment division issued an RFP for the OSGP investment consulting services on behalf of the OIC. The deadline for submission was April 22nd, which allowed close to 5 weeks for prospective parties to submit their proposals. We received 8 proposals in total from consulting firms, and then the committee, we independently scored all 8 proposals. We had scoring that was based on a variety of criteria, for example, key person backgrounds, firm history and experience, proposed service plan, performance monitoring and reporting, and of course the proposed fee schedule. At the conclusion of that process, the committee was able to select the 3 highest scoring firms for the semifinalist round. Then on June 12th, the 3 finalists presented to the committee. After we heard those presentations, the committee came together and we had a robust discussion, and we agreed that SageView Advisory Group was the most attractive candidate relative to OIC objectives, as well as the needs of the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and to Treasury staff. Just a few of the high-level differentiating factors that kind of led us to pick SageView include past familiarity with the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, as they were the consultant to the plan prior to Callen. Another big factor for us is that a huge piece of their business is focused on similar type governmental DC plans. For example, as of March, they provided consulting services to over 170 different 457 governmental plans. So that was attractive for us. We'd also be a relatively large client for them on an asset basis, leading us to believe that client service should be pretty strong. They did offer very competitive fees compared to some of the other consultants, so that bumped up their score. And the team is local to Portland, which is a factor we also considered. And then lastly, their qualitative and quantitative analysis, which they previewed to us during their presentation, was quite strong. So that was really the extent of the search process. So we also included on the slide the various consulting services that they're going to be providing us. I'm not going to go into detail on all of those, but I'll just kind of read them out. So they'll do investment policy development and review for the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, performance monitoring and reporting, plan design consulting, review of the plan services offered, a target date fund suitability study, committee fiduciary education, due diligence on our record keeper and vendors, fee benchmarking studies, as well as attendance for the 4 quarterly advisory committee meetings, and then an annual OIC meeting attendance as well. To the next slide. And with that, I'll ask for your approval, subject to the satisfactory negotiation of terms and conditions with staff working with legal counsel. The OSGP Investment Consultants and Search Committee recommends that the OSC pursue a non-discretionary consulting contract with SageView Advisory Group beginning today, September 4th, 2024. The committee further recommends pursuing an initial 3-year contract term with 2 pre-negotiated 2-year extensions available at your discretion. Let us know if you have any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just out of curiosity, I think you said, Claire, that we had partnered with SageView, I guess, earlier, 2017. Was there any reason for those who were part of the decision to go from SageView to Callen prior to 2017? Anyone have any tribal knowledge? I'm just curious more so than anything. Okay.
We were not around at the time, but they had probably a very attractive presentation and fees at the time. The color. We can get back to you on that if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have another question, if I might. Appreciate Ms. Allen, great presentation, really comprehensive description of all you went through. I'm just curious if there's anything that you were surprised by in that process or any lessons from that that might be applied to future RFPs or questions that might come in front of the OIC, any new insights that you gained as a result of that process?
I wouldn't say. I mean, it's a very competitive market, so it really came down to really, really minimal kind of differences between all the different consultants. I think for us, just building out the RFP process, you know, we built out and put in maybe different questions to start the RFP process to kind of help us weed through some of the questions that then came up later on. But otherwise, yeah, very competitive space.
I would echo that all of the proposals were very competitive and there wasn't just a clear winner in our mind.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I would entertain a motion.
Motion to accept the recommendation for Sage View.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion approved. Thank you both. We are nearing the end of the agenda, but we will just take a 6-minute break and come back here at 10:55 to close out. Are you asking for a gavel hit?
Hit it.
Shh. That'll do it.
Okay. The forward calendar was not listed on the agenda, but I'll let Rex go through the forward calendar.
Jam-packed, as always. Really, one thing to note with the new committee structure that was put in place earlier this year, we have reorganized the asset class annual reviews. So the asset class annual reviews will start in January and go through the first half of next year, grouped by the Treasury Committee's growth, which is public equity and private equity. There will be a special one for the opportunity portfolio in March, then real assets, real estate in April, and then fixed income diversifying strategies for the risk mitigation committee on May 28th. Other than that, we also have some updates to the OPERF and Common School guidelines and the asset allocation discussion for SAFE coming up for the next meeting.
We will move into the open discussion, and I would like to start the open discussion by welcoming on behalf of the council two new members, senior members of our investment staff. We have Tim Kane, who has joined us as the SIO of Diversifying Strategies, and welcome. And this will allow Ben to be solely focused, exclusively focused on real assets. And then we also have Amy Shung, who has joined us as the SIO of Fixed Income about 3 months ago. Alan started the meeting by mentioning how our staff is deeper and stronger than they've ever been, and I feel great about now being pretty fully staffed at the senior level as well. So welcome to you both. Does any members of – go ahead, Kevin.
Sure. Thanks, Chair. And just to give some context, circling back to what Alan started off as a reminder of why we're here, and that's to fund the pension plan. At the July PERS board meeting, we had the 2023 actuarial valuation results. And due to the fact that the investments weren't as good as the assumed rate over the last 2 years, the unfunded actuarial liability went from 73% to 72% with outside accounts, 29.4 billion, and 77% with side accounts, 2% down from, and it's now $24 billion. What will happen because of that is the average contribution rates will go up 4% for the 2025-27 biennia, and to put that in context, that's an increase in $1.76 billion in contributions over the next biennia, bringing it up to $7.7 billion worth of contributions over that two-year period. So not exactly good news, but those are the results, and I just wanted to make sure people were aware of them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Kevin on the contributions? Well, I have an item for open discussion. On behalf of the council, we have a couple of requests for future agenda items to be added at a time that makes sense based on the work that needs to be done, as well as the forward calendar that Rex presented. All three pertain to the work that we've been doing on the ESG and climate front. The first is for Rex. And staff, asking to have staff put together a presentation talking about what they are doing, what you all are doing already as it pertains to ESG and climate. That could consist of, you know, what are you doing today on your regular due diligence process? So each time we evaluate a prospective investment, it is our job to evaluate all of the risks associated with said investment, one of those risks being climate. So how are we going about doing that systematically? Another area would be staff resources. We have several members of staff that are tasked with job descriptions or roles specifically having to do with governance, engagement, ESG. What are the things that they're doing in this realm? And then the third request on this front would be measurement. So what measurements are we doing today on the portfolio as it pertains to ESG and climate? What metrics are we using? Are there standardized metrics that we have decided upon and we're using? What metrics are those, and what percentage of the portfolio are we capturing or not capturing in what asset classes? That would be the staff request. Number two pertains to consultants. So we had Makita and Aon here who gave us a wonderful presentation at a previous meeting answering the question that we posed, which was, with the Treasurer's Net Zero Plan as presented, can this be implemented within policy? What portions of it can, what portions cannot? With our existing policy, what changes may be required in order to do some of these things? The question that we didn't ask was, separate from the specific plan we have sitting in front of us today, what are best practices? What would you all recommend that we do? Not what in this can we do, but what would you recommend that we do? And that's very large and open-ended, so that's kind of a difficult presentation to make. You know, and I know that consultants act with our desires in mind. So I think if we said to them, we would like to have a net zero portfolio by 2050, how do we do it? What they would come forward with was how best to accomplish that given our circumstances, not necessarily, if you didn't ask us that question, what would we recommend? What would be best practices? So we can work together on trying to narrow that in over time to make it a question that is, that gets us somewhere. And then the last is really legal. And this is for Steve and the team at the Department of Justice. We asked what can we do with this net zero plan within policy, but what we didn't ask was, can we do this within legal statutes? And so if we wanted to implement, whether it's this iteration, some future iteration, something else entirely, before we can do anything, we have to know whether it's legal and whether we have statutory authority to do so. So we would love to have legal weigh in on that. And we can work with you also to narrow that question so that it's not so large and open-ended. So those are three things we'll put on the table as formal requests for the future. And perhaps if Rex and or Makita and Ann want to comment on what you think would be acceptable or appropriate timing.
Just as a starting thought.
Yes.
And maybe please don't hold me to this, but just as a starting thought, I think that incorporating within some of the asset class reviews, what we do from a due diligence perspective, and then also in terms of the quantitative, the engagement piece as well, I think those could be reasonably included inside of the asset class reviews. So maybe we'll start that with a private equity and public equity discussion, especially as those two discussions are going to be led by our two directors as well. I think within the public equity review, if we include some of the work that we've done on the engagement front, that would work as well.
Okay.
So just a starting idea, but I'll engage with my staff and also with consultants and maybe come back with a little bit more of a confirmed plan later.
Okay. Thoughts, comments? Any other topics that consultants, staff, or council members have for open discussion? Okay. We will enter the public comment section of the meeting, and I will not read my public comment script today. We have one comment from Susan. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Susan Palmiter, and I represent the DevEst Oregon Coalition. Yeah, this is the only statement today because it's vital for our message to be heard. Treasurer Reed has provided a net zero plan that has some important aspects. Makita and Aon have told you that the Treasurer's net zero plan doesn't fit within your policy and may violate your fiduciary duty. But Makita supports the similar, in some ways stronger, CalSTRS net zero policy. It finds no violations of fiduciary duty there. If your current policy doesn't allow a net zero plan, then you need to change your policy. Every careful person can see the financial crisis coming from the climate crisis that we are experiencing now. The climate crisis is a systemic risk to OPERF. There is no way of avoiding it. The closer the crisis, the fewer options you're going to have, and the more it will damage returns to OPERF. What we see with the current state of the net zero plan looks like decision paralysis. That's what got us into the subprime mortgage crisis. We've talked to a financial expert who said that folks kept giving constant rationalizations to continue with business as usual, even when they knew there was a problem and a crisis was coming. The worst rationalization was, if things blow up, we'll all be toast, so let's just not worry about it and continue making another deal. We see many parallels with the Treasury's current investment policy and processes that you're using. We are grateful that you're not in climate denial, but we believe you are in solution denial and solution delay. Please stop that denial and delay of how to protect OPERF from the damage that fossil fuel and other high emission investments pose to the portfolio. The damages will come within the working lives of current PERS members if you do not act. The time for solutions is now. Waiting 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, more consultants to have a plan to start implementing is a risk you and we cannot afford. So this is what we ask. A plan should be ready at the next OIC meeting for the public release and then approved and ready when the next treasurer walks in the door. Bring the Treasurer's net zero plan to a vote so we can see where each of you stands on it. change policy if that's what's needed to move forward. Put a moratorium on any new private investments that are heavily fossil fuel laden. Do not renew any of these type of currently held private investment funds. Clearly, private investments is an issue in this treasury, and we feel that is a way to start mitigating some of the issues with climate. If you need to get out of any of your private investments due to your liquidity issues, start with those that are fossil fuel ones. In every OIC meeting, we ask that you urgently address climate resilience and risk. We're looking for real leadership from each of you. We believe your fiduciary responsibility is to act now, and our job is to hold you accountable. Thank you.
Thank you. And that concludes today's meeting. Thank you all. We will see you next month. We are adjourned.
Thank you.